Hello, listeners. You are tuned into Iris and to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Wednesday, May 8th. I'm your volunteer reader, Bob Young. Let's take a look at the weather forecast for Northeast Iowa. Our forecast comes from KCRG. A fairly quiet start to the day will be replaced by a somewhat active finish as the storm system moves through the region. This morning features a mix of clouds and some clearer skies. Some of those clouds in central and western Iowa are trying to produce showers. Not all of this rain is reaching the ground, but if you live in northwest of a line from Grinnell to Vinton to Guttenberg, then you can see a sprinkle or light shower during the morning. Most areas, though, will stay dry. The combination of some sunshine throughout the day and a bit of a southeasterly breeze will help to bring temperatures back into the 70s yet again. Highs should be similar to what we experienced on Tuesday, and similar to Tuesday, the possibility of showers and storms returns this afternoon. It looks like the development of this activity should hold off until about 3 o'clock in most spots. While it should start out fairly scattered, a gradual increase in the number of showers and storms should take place into the evening and nighttime hours. The highest chance for widespread rain will be along and north of U.S. Highway 20 tonight, but just about anybody could see a storm during this active time frame. Like Tuesday, a few strong to severe storms could take place this afternoon. The ingredients for stronger storms will still be in place, though they will be fairly limited. An incidence or two of large hail or damaging winds could take place. Even a quick spin-up tornado may develop if things come together just right. Due to this low but still present potential, we encourage you to stay weather aware throughout the day. Make sure that your NOAA weather radio is turned on and ready to receive potential watches or warnings. Lows tonight dip into the low to mid-50s as cooler air begins to move in. Winds will shift to the east and then north as we go through the night. Showers and a few embedded storms will continue at times on Thursday, moving slowly from our northern zones to the south. A few more showers could pop up in the wake of this initial area, keeping the chance going into the afternoon. Highs tomorrow will be limited by more widespread cloud cover, along with the rain that we may see. Shower activity comes to an end by Thursday evening, leaving behind potentially clearing skies. A light northwesterly wind will continue to pull in chillier air, with most areas headed for the low 40s for lows. A couple of spots in the north could slip into the upper 30s, especially in low-lying areas like river valleys. A mix of sun and clouds appears to be probable on Friday, with slightly warmer temperatures than Thursday. Highs head for the low to upper 60s from north to south, which is near or just a couple of degrees below normal for this point on the calendar. This also is the first sign of a warm-up that will last for the next few days to follow. On Friday night, a quick moving disturbance will pass through the Great Lakes region, carrying a chance for some showers with it. Our area will be on the far southwest periphery of this area, but could be close enough that a few areas will see a brief sprinkle or shower. Any rainfall should stay quite light. Drier weather looks likely for much of Saturday and Sunday, as highs continue to push into the 70s. Mother's Day itself looks like it should be pretty decent, with above normal temperatures and plenty of opportunities to get out and about if you have plans with Mom. After a break from more active weather for a few days, the chance for more precipitation returns as soon as Monday. A frontal boundary will be nearer the state at times, providing the focus for the occasional development of showers and storms. The chance is slight on Monday at this point, with an increasing threat of showers and storms toward the middle of next week. Things may reach a bit of a peak in terms of rainfall potential on Wednesday, as an area of low pressure tracks through the region. Temperatures next week look to stay on the warm side, with highs in the mid to upper 70s for many of us. Now, turning to the front page of today's Courier, the top story is titled, Daniels Details Meeting Former President. Porn actor says she was paid to stay quiet about sexual encounter. This story comes to us by way of the Associated Press, and the dateline is New York. With Donald Trump sitting just feet away, Stormy Daniels testified Tuesday at the former president's hush money trial about a sexual encounter the porn actor says they had in 2006 that resulted in her being paid to keep silent during the presidential race 10 years later. Jurors appeared riveted as Daniels offered a detailed and at times graphic account of the encounter, which Trump denies. Trump stared straight ahead when Daniels entered the courtroom, later whispering to his lawyers and shaking his head as she testified. The testimony was by far the most awaited spectacle in a trial that has toggled between tabloid-esque elements and dry record-keeping details. A courtroom appearance by a porn actor who says she had an intimate encounter with a former American president added to the long list of historic firsts in a landmark case laden with claims of sex, payoffs, and cover-ups, and unfolding as the presumptive Republican nominee makes another bid for the White House. Daniels veered into salacious details, despite the repeated objections of defense lawyers, who demanded a mistrial over what they said were prejudicial and irrelevant comments. Quote, "This is the kind of testimony that makes it impossible to come back from," attorney Todd Blanche said. The judge rejected the request and said defense lawyers should have raised more objections during the testimony. The Trump team later in the day used its opportunity to question Daniels to paint her as motivated by personal animus and profiting off her claims against Trump. Quote, "Am I correct that you hate President Trump?" defense lawyer Susan Natchez asked Daniels. Quote, "Yes," she acknowledged. Daniels' statements are central to the case because in the final weeks of Trump's 2016 Republican presidential campaign, his then lawyer and personal fixer, Michael Cohen, paid her $130,000 to keep quiet about what she says was an awkward and unexpected sexual encounter with Trump in July 2006, at a celebrity golf outing in Lake Tahoe. Trump pleaded not guilty. Trump is charged with 34 felony counts of falsifying business records in connection with the payments. The trial is the first of his four criminal cases to reach a jury. Led by a prosecutor's questioning, Daniels described how an initial meeting at a golf tournament where they discussed the adult film industry progressed to a brief sexual encounter that she said Trump initiated after inviting her to dinner and back to his hotel suite. She said she didn't feel physically or verbally threatened, though she knew his bodyguard was outside the suite. There was also what she perceived as an imbalance of power. Trump was bigger and blocking the way, she said. At the time, Trump was married to his wife, Melania, who has not been in court for the trial. Daniels said Trump told her they did not sleep in the same room, prompting him to shake his head at the defense table. After it ended, Daniels said, quote, "It was really hard to get my shoes because my hands were shaking so hard," unquote. Quote, he said, "Oh, it was great. Let's get together again, honey bunch," Daniels said. "I just wanted to leave." In the years since the encounter was disclosed, Daniels has emerged as a vocal Trump antagonist, sharing her story innumerable times and criticizing the former president with mocking and pejorative jabs. But there was no precedent for Tuesday's testimony when she came face to face with Trump and was asked under oath in an austere courtroom to describe her experiences to a jury, weighing whether to convict a former American president of felony crimes for the first time in history. She told jurors how she met Trump because the adult film studio she worked for at the time sponsored one of the holes on the golf course. She said they had a brief conversation when Trump's group passed through, chatting about the adult film industry and her directing abilities. The celebrity real estate developer remarked that she must be the smart one if she was making films, Daniels recalled. Later, in an area known as the gift room, where celebrity golfers collected gift bags and swag, Trump remembered her as the smart one and asked her to dinner, Daniels said. She said her then-publicist suggested in a phone call that Trump's invitation was a good excuse to skip a work dinner and would make a great story and perhaps help her career. Quote, what could possibly go wrong? She recalled the publicist saying. In 2011, several years after she and Trump were last in touch, she said she learned from her agent that the story of her encounter with Trump had made its way to a magazine. She said she agreed to an interview for $15,000 because, quote, I'd rather make the money than somebody make money off of me, and at least I could control the narrative. The story never ran, but later that year, she was alarmed when an item turned up on a website. Perhaps seeking to preempt defense claims that she was in urgent need of a massive payout, Daniels testified that she was in the best financial shape of her life when she authorized her manager to shop her story during the 2016 presidential campaign. Daniels was expected to return to the witness stand Thursday when the trial resumes. Testimony so far has made clear that at the time of the payment to Daniels, Trump and his campaign were reeling from the October 2016 publication of the never-before-seen 2005 Access Hollywood footage in which he boasted about groping women without their permission. Iowa Attorney General joins lawsuit challenging Title IX rules. Story filed by Caleb McCullough of the Courier's Des Moines Bureau. Dateline Des Moines. Iowa Attorney General Brenna Byrd joined a lawsuit seeking to block new Title IX regulations proposed by the Biden administration that prohibit discrimination in education based on sexual orientation and gender identity. The lawsuit, led by Arkansas and Missouri, and joined by Iowa, Nebraska, and North Dakota, argues the Department of Education's proposed Title IX rules overstep the agency's bounds and infringe on existing state law. It is the latest of multiple lawsuits lodged by at least 20 Republican states against the rule, which the department announced in April and is set to take effect on August 1st. Republican Governor Kim Reynolds said on Monday she had directed Byrd to litigate the rule. Although the rule does not govern athletic participation, Byrd accused President Joe Biden of threatening girls' sports in a statement. Quote, with Biden's radical gender ideology mandate, he has not only robbed young women of the opportunity to safely compete and succeed in the sports they love, he has violated their privacy, Byrd said. Quote, no schoolgirl should be forced to change next to or share shower spaces with boys. I am suing to stop Biden's war on women and protect girls in schools, unquote. The proposed rule effectively expands the scope of the 1972 law that prohibits sex-based discrimination in education at K-12 schools and higher education institutions. The new rules extend those protections to prohibit discrimination based on sexual orientation, gender identity, and sex characteristics. The changes also expand the type of sexual harassment and assault claims a school must respond to and change the grievance process for those claims. Quote, these final regulations build on the legacy of Title IX by clarifying that all our nation's students can access schools that are safe, welcoming, and respect their rights, U.S. Secretary of Education Miguel Cardona said in a news release. In the lawsuit, the states argue that Title IX refers only to biological sex, and the administration's interpretation of the law exceeds its authority under federal law and the Constitution. Many of the states suing, including Iowa, have laws that would be in violation of the proposed rules once they take effect. Reynolds signed a law last year that requires school students and staff to use the bathroom that matches their sex assigned at birth. In a statement on Monday, our Governor Kim Reynolds said the Biden administration is marginalizing girls and women by expanding the definition of sex discrimination to include gender identity and sexual orientation. Quote, "There are undeniable and important biological differences between males and females," Reynolds said. "It's a fact that cannot be denied, no matter how inconvenient it is for the president during an election year. While he caves to the radical left, I will continue to protect the rights of women of all ages," unquote. The state lawsuits across the country, supported by conservative civil rights organizations, argue that the Education Department overstepped its authority and submitted arbitrary, unworkable rules. The Department of Education has warned any states that do not follow the law will risk losing federal education funding, according to K-12 Dive. The rules do not weigh in on how educational institutions should approach the participation of transgender girls and women in sports, which has been a focus of Reynolds and Republicans nationally. The Department of Education proposed a separate rule relating to athletics last year, and it is still formulating the final terms of the rule. Reynolds signed a law in 2022 that banned transgender girls and women in Iowa from competing on the sports team corresponding with their gender identity in the high school and college levels. Last year, Reynolds signed a law that requires students and staff at public schools to use the bathroom and changing facilities that align with their sex assigned at birth. Schools must make a private, single-use bathroom available for anyone who requests it. That law would run afoul of the new regulations, which require schools to allow transgender students to use the bathroom that aligns with their gender identity. Reynolds proposed a bill this year that would define terms like man, woman, male, and female to align with a person's sex assigned at birth. The bill would have required government accommodations to be provided to a person based on their sex assigned at birth rather than gender identity. The bill advanced out of the House committee but did not pass either chamber. Wet weather keeps farmers out of the fields across Iowa. Story written by Courier staff, and it begins with a photograph of a crop field north of Cedar Falls, and it's very muddy, and there's pools of water standing. Dateline Des Moines. Field work activities were limited as rain across Iowa held farmers to just 1.4 days suitable for field work during the week ending Sunday, according to the USDA National Agricultural Statistics Service. The weekly crop report from the U.S. Department of Agriculture said rain during the past 2 weeks has resulted in some counties moving out of the extreme drought stage to severe drought. Quote, "Farmers are feeling anxious about the multiple rounds of rain produced soggy conditions that have not been fit for planting progress," Iowa Secretary of Agriculture Mike Nagy said in a statement. Quote, "We need a stretch of sunshine and dry weather so that farmers can get back in the field," unquote. Just 8% of Iowa's expected corn crop was planted during the week ending Sunday, for a total of 47% planted. This meant progress went from ahead of average to lagging 2 days behind, both last year and the five-year average. 7% of the corn crop has emerged 3 days ahead of last year and 1 day ahead of the average. Soybean planting progress fell behind the previous year, with 5% of Iowa's expected soybean crop planted during the week ending Sunday, for a total of 30% of the expected soybean crop planted, 2 days behind last year. 4% of the soybean crop has emerged. Unseasonably wet conditions continued through the reporting period, with several disturbances crossing the state, according to Justin Glisson, state climatologist with the Iowa Department of Agriculture and Land Stewardship. Rain on already saturated ground produced flooding in pockets of northern and southeastern Iowa. Temperatures varied from cooler than average in northwestern Iowa to unseasonably warm in the southeast. The statewide average temperature was near normal at 55 degrees. We turn the page now to the campaign almanac, Miller Meeks, endorsed by Governor Reynolds and Attorney General Byrd. Congresswoman Marionette Miller Meeks has been endorsed by the Republican Party election of two of Iowa's top statewide elected Republicans, Governor Kim Reynolds and Attorney General Brenna Byrd, according to Miller Meeks's campaign. Miller Meeks is running for a third two-year term in the U.S. House in eastern Iowa's 1st Congressional District. She is being challenged in the GOP primary by Republican David Pouch, a prayer breakfast organizer from Davenport. Democrat Christina Bohannon, who unsuccessfully challenged Miller Meeks in 2022, is running again this year. Reynolds and Byrd gave statements in support of Miller Meeks in a news release from her campaign. Quote, Miller Meeks is feared by Democrats, calling out their hypocrisy as a doctor and veteran, Reynolds said in the news release. Added Byrd, Miller Meeks is a dedicated public servant with a track record of success in standing up for Iowa families and farmers. Whether she is fighting on the front lines as a doctor, soldier, or lawmaker, Marionette has been the leader Iowans can count on, unquote. Iowa's primary election is June 4th. VFW Foundation beneficiary of fundraiser. The nonprofit Iowa Veterans of Foreign Wars Foundation will be this year's beneficiary of Republican U.S. Senator Joni Ernst's annual Roast and Ride fundraiser, Ernst campaign announced. A different veterans-related group is selected to benefit from Ernst fundraiser each year. Quote, the IVFWF is honored to be a part of an event championing those who have sacrificed so much for our state and country. Russell Doc Sheffel, president of the Iowa VFW Foundation, said in a news release from the Ernst campaign. Quote, we're looking forward to riding alongside Senator Joni Ernst and fellow Iowans to come out to support veterans, unquote. Ernst 2024 Roast and Ride fundraiser is scheduled for June 1st. The event begins with a motorcycle ride that will start at 9:15 a.m. at Big Barn Harley-Davidson in Des Moines and finish at the Iowa State Fairgrounds. The event then heads indoors for a program at the Fairgrounds Animal Learning Center. That program is scheduled to run from 12:30 to 2:30 p.m. Ernst's campaign said riders and supporters are encouraged to purchase tickets in advance at iowaroastandride.com. Democrats set fundraiser date. The Iowa Democratic Party's annual Liberty and Justice Celebration fundraiser has been scheduled for July 27th, the state party announced. Additional details regarding the time, location, and speakers will be provided later, the party said. However, tickets can be purchased online now. Quote, this year, the LJ will get us ready to have a terrific national convention, help us organize our army of volunteers, and fund our Get Out the Vote efforts in November, Iowa Democratic Party Chairwoman Rita Hart said in a news release. TikTok sues U.S. to block law that could ban the app. Congress singled out social media platform, Chinese company says. The story came from the Associated Press. TikTok and its Chinese parent company filed a lawsuit Tuesday, charging a new U.S. law that would ban the popular video sharing app in the U.S. unless it's sold to an approved buyer, saying it unfairly singles out the platform and is an unprecedented attack on free speech. In its lawsuit, ByteDance says the new law vaguely paints its ownership of TikTok as a national security threat to circumvent the First Amendment, despite no evidence that the company poses a threat. It also says the law is so, quote, obviously unconstitutional that its sponsors are instead portraying it as a way to regulate TikTok's ownership. Quote, for the first time in history, Congress has enacted a law that subjects a single named speech platform to a permanent nationwide ban and bars every American from participating in a unique online community with more than 1 billion people worldwide, ByteDance asserts in the lawsuit filed in a Washington appeals court. The lawsuit is the latest turn in what's shaping up to be a protracted legal fight over TikTok's future in the United States, and one that could end up before the Supreme Court. Boy Scouts of America announces name change. Scouting America, meant to be inclusive and boost membership. Story by the Associated Press, Dateline, Irving, Texas. The Boy Scouts of America is changing its name for the first time in its 114-year history and will become Scouting America. It's a significant shift as the organization emerges from bankruptcy following a flood of sexual abuse claims and seeks to focus on inclusion. The organization, steeped in tradition, has made seismic changes after decades of turmoil, from finally allowing gay youth to welcoming girls throughout its ranks. With an eye on increasing flagging membership numbers, the Irving, Texas-based organization announced the name change Tuesday at its annual meeting in Florida. Quote, in the next 100 years, we want any youth in America to feel very, very welcome to come into our programs, said Roger Crone, who took over last fall as president and chief executive officer. The organization began allowing gay youth in 2013 and ended a blanket ban on gay adult leaders in 2015. In 2017, it made the historic announcement that girls would be accepted as Cub Scouts as of 2018 and into the flagship Boy Scout program in 2019. There were almost 1,000 young women in the inaugural class of female Eagle Scouts in 2021. Unusual for a Wednesday, we do have one obituary in today's paper. Andrew James Loop, 51, treasured son, brother, spouse, and father, died by suicide on May 4th at his home. Andrew was beloved by all who knew him. Visitation will be from 3 p.m. to 7 p.m. on Friday, May 10th, at Grandview Methodist Church, 3342 John Wesley Drive in Dubuque, and from 9 a.m. to 10 a.m. on Saturday, May 11th, at Grandview Methodist Church. Funeral services will be at 10:30 a.m. on Saturday, May 11th, at Grandview Methodist Church, and will be live-streamed. Reverend Tom Schinkel will officiate. Arrangements are entrusted to Eaglehoff, Seigert, and Casper Funeral Home. Born in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, Andrew was the fourth child of Bertrand H. and Shirley M. Denny Loop. He married his queen, Brenda Taylor, on June 28, 1994, the third generation of Taylors to be married on that day. They were blessed with a son, Skyler, in 1998. After graduating from Monticello High School in 1992, he attended the University of Northern Iowa, and in his first semester there, he met a lovely lass in the lunch line of Redeker Dining Center. Chaos ensued when he returned for second semester, and she no longer worked at the lunch line. Luckily, he found her again working in the dinner shift after a disastrous first date with one broken cup holder in his 1992 Chevy Cavalier and one case of food poisoning. He recounted later that he knew she was the one since she came to check on him between classes. He graduated with a bachelor degree in business management in 1996. He was a lifelong learner and returned to school and completed his MBA in 2003 through St. Ambrose. After moving up and down Highway 20 several times, Andy, Brenda, and Skyler settled in Wisconsin in 2021. More recently, Andrew had completed more than half of his coursework to obtain a doctorate in business administration and was looking forward to continuing to teach at the collegiate level in his retirement. Andrew had many adopted dads through his life after losing his own father at a young age. One of those adopted dads, Ralphie Muller, inspired Andy's lifelong obsession with classic cars. Andrew completed restoration of his 1965 Mercury Comet while still in high school and worked off and on over the years as time and money allowed on his father-in-law's 1955 Chevy pickup and his mentor Ralphie's 1967 Chevy Camaro. One of his favorite things to do was burnouts in areas the police didn't frequent. Andrew and Skyler spent many years together through Cub Scouts and Boy Scouts, all the way through Skyler's Eagle Scout with Gold Palm. This included trips to the National Jamboree, Ockpick, and Philmont. Andy's favorite methods of cooking were with Dutch ovens and smokers. Andy and Skyler were also avid weightlifters. Andrew will be remembered as a tireless worker and for his compassion for others. He spent lots of time working with his teams to develop potential and provide advancement opportunities for others. He gave away dozens of copies of Strength Finders over the years to enable others to find their passions as he had. For 5 years, he mentored veterans returning to civilian work life for American Corporate Partners. And also for 5 years, he was an adjunct professor in project management at UNI. He was the first adjunct professor to receive the Distinguished Professor Award in 2021. Andrew is survived by his wife Brenda and son Skyler, as well as his favorite mother-in-law Alice. He is also survived by sisters Nancy Walton of Anamosa, Rosie, spouse Blake Jones of Parkland, Florida, and Deanna, spouse Stephen Thomas of Marion, and brother-in-law Bob Taylor of Knoxville, and nieces and nephews, Brandon Walton, Courtney Lee, Ashley Kurtels, Hunter, and Tyler Volk, and great-nieces Lydia, Peyton, and Maya. Andrew was preceded in death by his parents, Bert and Shirley Loop, father-in-law Ron, and brother-in-law Mike Palmersheim. And now, listeners, we'll just take a moment to remind you that you're listening to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Wednesday, May 8th, on IRIS, that's IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and the Print Handicapped. Now let's listen to this message.
As veterans, we're no strangers to helping others.
That's what we were taught, service before self.
But we do have one question for the veterans listening.
When is the last time you reached out for help?
If you or someone you know needs resources, whether it's for stress, finances, employment, or mental health, don't wait. Reach out.
Find more information at va.gov/reach. That's va.gov/reach.
Brought to you by the United States Department of Veterans Affairs and the Ad Council.
Now, let's turn to the opinion section. Our first piece today comes from the Iowa Capital Dispatch. It's titled, Lying, Trespassing, and Hat Wearing are Essential Parts of Morel Hunting by Avery Gregorich. And we begin with a close-up photograph of a morel mushroom, and it's nestled in between twigs and leaves. Here's the text of the story. Perhaps more than anything else, I'm proudest to have fallen into a life with a person who, every springtime, becomes tragically serious about looking for morel mushrooms, also serious about tracking tornadoes on her phone, TV shows about a place called Skinwalker Ranch, and a little roulette about once a year. This life together may not exist without morels. Sarah and I first started spending time together after shifts in search of them, sometimes by flashlight late at night, and always in places where we were not supposed to be. The first morel we ever found together in the last stand of trees a Wells Fargo campus hadn't yet claimed, rests on a bookshelf that holds some sentimental CDs and an inherited mini-bottle liquor collection. They shrink down to next to nothing and are as hard as rocks. Over the years, we've started to bring our friends along with us, trying to show them the joy and absurdity of parking on the shoulder of the highway and heading out with the rest of the walking stick and Walmart bag crowd. So far, it's been a success. Sarah's best friend now carries a meat thermometer out with her while she's walking, stabbing the ground, and checking the soil temperatures wherever she happens to find them. Irony is that Sarah and I don't eat them, not anymore. She got sick on them once, all mixed up with lots of keg beer. I never did like the taste. So many hours spent each spring, and we wind up giving them to friends or folks who can no longer get out and find the things themselves. You'd be surprised how many older Iowans over the years have wandered into the suburban grocery stores where we've worked and asked to buy morel mushrooms. We'd always take their number, say we'd try to help them out if we could, much to the worry of our bosses, who probably have great paranoid dreams of liability lawsuits. Once we met up with a woman in a mall parking lot and gave her morels. She nearly cried, promised us that they would make her Easter dinner and her mother's year. She said that her mother was in her 90s. Those particular morels marked time well spent. Most do. Superstition and outright lies abound in searching for morels. Lucky talismans and T-shirts are both encouraged. The deer and Lone Star ticks don't mind either way. Sarah always sings a song or repeats a secret morel mantra. It's tradition now that once I find my first mushroom, I pantomime a laugh like Nelson Muntz from The Simpsons. Ha ha. If you come across someone else out hunting on public land, it's a requisite to lie and say you haven't found any, especially if you have. Know that they are doing the same. The one family rule we have was taught to me by my grandfather, and that's to wear a hat. Morel lore. You only bring out the bag after you find a second mushroom. First one found always goes into the hat as a sort of offering. Carry that around until you find another. It's then, and only then, that you can bring out a bag. Mesh is best, for the belief is that as you continue to walk, you will spread the spores of the morels wherever you go. Unlike most everything about morels, the line between ritual and fact blurs, becomes unimportant, and yet we follow. I can't be alone in acknowledging that it's getting harder for me to keep track of seasons, to keep track of time at all. The new climate binary seems to be drought, then cold. Sometimes it's 70 in March. The next week it snows. Even the weather here is burned out, polarized. But I can always tell when it's morel season. It rains and sometimes hails. There's May apples growing on the forest floor, and the wild Virginia bluebells are approached by a loud and lumbering bumblebee. Then a hummingbird shows up from a winter spent somewhere south, probably beachside, now half starved for Iowa County sugar water. We've seen more cars parked with ours out at country parks this year than any year before. A retail work schedule allows for time off during the week, and still, they're out there in the early afternoon, hiking the trails and swinging stick. Earlier this week, a man sauntered up to us in the woods, intent on learning us about morels. There must be something about the two of us, some part of our appearance or walk or demeanor, that encourages strangers to try to teach us about things that we already know. As if two bleeding hearts in bicycle caps couldn't possibly also be interested and quite capable of finding and identifying morel mushrooms. We drive our hand-me-down pickup around this county for just this reason, trying to pass as locals in town, most known for one of Iowa's worst chemical spills in recent decades. Any luck? He says. Sarah, not really. How about you? A little. What you're looking for are these, he says. He comes up to me and holds out a gray Morel that could fit on the end of a pencil. This is a gray one, he says, pinching the stem. And this is a yellow one, he says, raising up his other hand. It's a verpa, or false Morel, which, as the name implies, isn't considered a Morel at all, at least not in our house, and most of the various Morel hunting websites that Sarah traffics, like the Iowa Morel Report and the Great Morel. I just don't have it in my Midwestern heart to tell him he's wrong, that without correct preparation, it's mildly poisonous to even the most hardened wild mushroom eater. Quote, looks like a lot of work, I say instead, keeping a gray Morel tucked inside my palm, pushed into my back pocket. I thanked him for showing me his haul, and he headed down off the hill and to his van. Sure, he'd been a help to some wayward strays out for the first time, spurred on by social media or something. We stayed out a while longer, finding a few along the path he'd left by. I worried about not telling him about the verpa. But he didn't ask, and as he could rightly tell, we're not from here, and therefore not to be trusted. Clearly, we arrived into this morel season with a tornado, and I'm writing this tonight beneath the threat of another. We've reached home to shut the windows and get the clothes down off the line. This evening's total, 12 gray and sort of sunburnt morel mushrooms, 5 still traveling ticks, and a dead robin. Thanks to the rain, the season will last a few more days, maybe another week or so. Who knows? Everybody claims to be an expert on the whole thing. I know for certain that none of them will get it exactly right, but we're sure to be out there until the warm, bitter end. Now from the Iowa Capital Dispatch, Iowa nursing homes added to national list of worst care facilities. Homes cited for insufficient staffing, resident injuries, and death. Story written by Clark Kaufman, and begins with a photograph of a nursing home taken from the parking lot. And here's the text. 3 Iowa nursing homes have been added to the federal government's list of the worst care facilities in the nation. Over the past 2 months, 3 homes were deemed eligible for inclusion on the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services national list of special focus facilities. They join 7 other Iowa care facilities already deemed eligible for inclusion on CMS's periodically updated list of nursing homes that have recurring serious quality of care problems. The 3 Iowa homes added to the eligibility list since February are Fleur Heights Center for Wellness and Rehab in Des Moines, Pine Acres Rehabilitation and Care Center in West Des Moines, and Dunlop Specialty Care. They join 7 other Iowa facilities that were already considered eligible for special focus status and increased oversight by regulators. Correctionville Specialty Care, Embassy Rehab and Care Center of Sergeant Bluff, Genesis Senior Living of Des Moines, Harmony West of West Des Moines, Iowa City Rehab and Health Care Center, The Ivy at Davenport, and Westwood Specialty Care of Sioux City. Of the 10 eligible facilities in Iowa, 3 of them, those located in Dunlop, Sioux City, and Correctionville, are operated by the West Des Moines chain Care Initiatives. In addition to the homes deemed eligible for special focus status, Iowa has 2 care facilities that are officially designated special focus facilities and, as a result, are operating under additional scrutiny and oversight by the government. Iowa's special focus facilities are Aspire of Gowrie, which has had special focus status for 7 months, and Arbor Court of Mount Pleasant, which has had special focus status for 13 months. The 3 Iowa homes deemed new eligible for inclusion on the federal list have a recent history of regulatory issues. Dunlap Specialty Care. In December 2023, State inspectors alleged the staff at the Dunlop home failed to adequately respond to a fatal head injury sustained by a resident in a fall. In June of 2023, CMS imposed a $45,075 fine against the home due to allegations of residents' abuse and failure to keep residents safe. At the time, inspectors alleged a female resident of the home had physically abused her fellow residents, slapping one of them in the face, hitting another in the back of the head, punching a resident in the face, and throwing water at another resident. A woman who was struck by a full can of soda thrown by the resident later told inspectors the abuse was part of a pattern the facility had failed to address. The police were summoned on at least two occasions, but the abuse continued, she said, adding, quote, "I'm not a target. I am a human being. Something has to get done. How do I know if I'm going to be safe?" Unquote. Dunlap Care Center was on the list of eligible special focus facilities for most of 2023, but appears to have dropped off the list at some point, then added back to it, as CMS currently claims it has been on the list for only 1 month. The next one is Pine Acres Rehabilitation and Care Center. In July 2023, state officials visited this nursing home to conduct an inspection, but not before the home had racked up 13 complaints, the oldest of which dated back 109 days. Over the next several weeks, an additional 12 complaints were filed against the home, and a second inspection took place. Eventually, all of the 25 complaints were substantiated by inspectors, and Pine Acres was cited for 62 regulatory violations. Last year, CMS fined the facility $189,685 for violations tied to a resident's leg amputation as the result of the home's failure to respond to signs of blood poisoning, septic shock, a serious bone infection, and gangrene. Pine Acres' primary owner, New York investor Akiko Aiki, has ties to other nursing home owners who currently stand accused of defrauding the government, according to CMS. And next, Fluor Heights Center for Wellness and Rehab. This nursing home has Iowa's worst record of compliance with a federal requirement that nursing homes maintain sufficient staffing levels to care for residents. Over a 9-month period between May 2023 and February 2024, the home was cited but never fined 5 times for insufficient staff, more than any other facility in the state. In October of 2023, state inspectors visited this facility to investigate a backlog of 14 complaints alleging substandard care. While one inspector watched, a male resident of the home called out from his bed, quote, "Help me." A worker reportedly turned off the man's call light and left, telling the man she was busy. "I'm a human being. I need help," the man told the inspector. The man switched his call light back on, and after 15 minutes, another worker allegedly came in, asked what he needed, switched off the light, and left. In their report, the inspectors noted there had been no director of nursing on the Fluor Heights payroll for 3 months, and there weren't enough workers on hand to get residents out of bed, serve meals, or assist those who needed help eating. Homes eligible for oversight don't receive it. The Federal Special Focus Facilities list is updated periodically by CMS and includes homes deemed by the agency to have, quote, "a history of serious quality issues," unquote. Nationally, there are 88 nursing facilities on the list, with one or two slots filled by each state. Those homes are enrolled in a special program intended to stimulate improvements in their quality of care through increased regulatory oversight. Because the number of special focus facilities is capped, new facilities, even those that have earned CMS's lowest ratings for quality, can't be named a special focus facility until the other homes in that same state shut down or improve and graduate from the program. That's a process that can take 4 years or more. As a result, there are several homes in each state that are designated as eligible for special focus status due to their ongoing quality of care issues, but they are unable to benefit from actual enrollment in the program. Iowa, generally, has 10 nursing homes on the list of eligible facilities. Currently, the only Iowa home listed as having graduated from the program after a sustained period of improving care is Touchstone Healthcare Community in Sioux City. However, Touchstone's graduation appears to coincide with the home's closing in July 2022 amid ongoing quality of care issues. Typically, all of the homes that are deemed eligible for special focus designation have about twice the average number of violations cited by state inspectors. They have more serious problems than most other nursing homes, including harm or serious injury to residents, and they have established a pattern of serious problems that has persisted over a long period of time. Let's return to local news from the Courier. Spooner takes the stand, said he didn't start the fire. This was written by Jeff Reinitz and begins with a photograph of the fire-damaged home, and they are firemen fighting the fire at the time the picture was taken. Dateline Waterloo. John Walter Spooner took the stand in his own defense on Tuesday, giving his account of what happened in the hours leading up to the fire that killed his lifetime friend. Spooner, of Denver, had been staying with Tony Grider in August of 2022 while awaiting medical appointments in Waterloo for hepatitis. Grider's East 2nd Street home caught on fire on the morning of August 19, 2023, and Grider, 60, died of smoke inhalation and burns. During the investigation, police found surveillance video from a nearby church and cell phone video taken by a neighbor showing Spooner meandering the street before the blaze, sometimes tossing a gas can, sometimes flicking a lighter, and occasionally muttering something about fire. Videos show him approaching the house, returning to the street, and then flames erupting from the house minutes later. Police charged Spooner with first-degree murder, alleging he killed Grider while committing arson. Spooner, now 61, said he had known Grider since they were 8 years old, and in recent years he had been living with Grider on and off. Grider had two other roommates, and he held his home out to be a sober living facility, although testimony hinted it was light on the sober part. Fire officials described the home as a hoarder-type house. Spooner, who admitted to using meth, said he had been up for 2 or 3 days. On the night of August 17, 2022, he and Grider had gone fishing. The following day, Grider and others were working on a pickup truck in the front yard, while Spooner said he was cleaning up around the house. Quote, "There was so much garbage, I was trying to help out," Spooner said. He said at some point in the day, an acquaintance of one of Grider's roommates became involved in an argument and threatened to set the house on fire. On the night of August 18, 2022, Spooner said he remained awake and was cleaning the kitchen while others in the house went to sleep sometime after midnight. He said he didn't have a bed and tried to sleep on the dining room floor to avoid bed bugs that infested the home. He also said that people who had been kicked out of the house as part of an argument over the purchase and use of drugs sneaked back inside and were messing with him. Quote, "They were trying to scare us and came in the basement. It got quiet after a while after I told them to come into the light to talk to me," he said. He said he went to the basement to find them, but that they had unscrewed the light bulbs. Quote, "I started walking to the living room and bam, someone hit the wall real hard and scared the heck out of me, and I fell in a pile of bike parts by the basement door," he said. He said he took 2 cigarettes out of his fishing tackle box and then discovered his lighter didn't work, so he went out to a nearby gas station to look for a new one. The gas station was closed, so he sat on the steps by the church and eventually returned, which is when he encountered his neighbor, who was filming him with her camera. He said he began acting weird so she wouldn't bother him. He said he was calling the Navy to blow up the church parking lot. Quote, "I was just saying something crazy, trying to make her leave," Spooner said. After she pulled away, he said he went up to Grider's house and noticed a small ring of fire burning on a mat on the porch near a gas can. He said he hurled the gas can from the porch to keep it away from the fire, and then he put a tote on the flames. The fire went out, he said. He said he walked back across the street and sat on a step where he nodded off. Then he awoke. He noticed fire coming from Grider's house, according to his account. He said he ran up to the home and started yelling, but he didn't call 911 because he didn't have a phone, and he didn't think to run to the fire station, which was about 2 blocks away. He said he didn't pour any gas on the porch and didn't set the fire. Much of the preceding testimony pitted fire experts for the state, who said the fire started with gasoline on the porch, against fire experts for the defense, who said the fire started in the living room, possibly with an electrical short. And now, friends, that's going to do it for today's reading of the Waterloo-Cedar Falls Courier for Wednesday, May 8th. I'm your volunteer reader, Bob Young. Remember, you can listen to a recording of this reading of the Courier or of the other newspapers around the state that we read. Just visit our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. And we want to thank you for listening to your IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.